Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, Episode 4. I'm your host, Nick Ortego. An investigative story out of Florida claims tougher certification tests for teachers are fueling a teacher shortage. Also, we'll tell you what major U.S. city is going to try and teach like the Swiss. Plus, a New Jersey student had his yearbook picture photoshopped because he was wearing a Trump t-shirt, and the teacher that photoshopped it is in trouble. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast for educators that covers some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, each week we'll interview a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week we have Dr. Stephen Farber. Dr. Farber is the founder of BioEyes. BioEyes is dedicated to getting K-12 students excited about science, and their mission starts with a zebrafish. It's amazing work they're doing. We're looking forward to sharing that with you later in the show. Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Ortego here, and I'm joined with teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt, and we have Nick Peterman of schoolstatus.com sitting in for Russ Davis. Lissa, how you doing?
I'm great.
Nick, how's it going with you? Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Good. Now, you are filling in for Russ. Russ is a little bit under the weather today, but tell me what you do for School Status and a little bit about your background in teaching.
Sure. Well, I'm serve as vice president for the company, and that's a big fancy title for really just making sure that all the wheels stay on and monitoring, you know, what's going on in each department and just kind of helping everybody do what they do. Most of the work gets done by those guys, so it's been really enjoyable. And, you know, having come from a teaching background, it's a new challenge, which I enjoy.
Now, you're dialing in. I guess you've been on the road a little bit. You're in Louisiana, is that right?
That's right. Right now I'm calling in from Baton Rouge.
All right. Hello to all the LSU fans out there in Baton Rouge. Is their baseball team still in the running? Are they doing well?
Yeah. They're headed to Omaha.
Yeah. Oh, good. So, good.
Yeah, we're all excited here in Louisiana.
Excellent. All right, well, it's time to jump right into it and get into the teacher's lounge. And I know Lissa's got a pretty interesting story. She's been following that. I think a lot of educators can probably relate to. Lissa?
Oh, so frustrating. This is a story out of Florida, but really it's all over. But just a report recently about the teacher's certification exam in Florida has in some cases, a 60% drop, a 30% drop. So basically, people want to be teachers, and they're not able to because they can't pass the test.
So they made the test harder to be certified to be a teacher. Why is that a bad thing, though?
Well, I mean, it's not a... I see what they're saying is, you know, you don't want just anybody coming in and saying, you know what, I have a degree. Let me just go pass this test real quick, and I'm going to go teach science. But they're not necessarily an effective teacher. I think they feel that by making the test harder, then the teachers are more qualified. But that's not what it equals, because there's no number one, these tests are timed, and they're testing things that are maybe not necessarily what that teacher is going to be teaching. You know, really, I have experience with this. I mean, I'm going to sound a little heated, but, you know, I have been teaching a long time, so they change things over the course of your certification. So to be highly qualified to be able to teach middle school mathematics, for example, well, now you can't just go teach middle school mathematics, even though you're certified a long time ago. We won't go into how long ago certified to teach to teach K through 8th. Well, now they changed it to where to be able to teach middle school mathematics, you have to have this middle school mathematics certification, and which would, for most teachers from back in the day, would require you to take a test. I took the test. I sat for the test. It was a time test on the computer with an online calculator, which is hard enough to click through. But some of the things that appeared on this middle school mathematics test was trigonometry, which is not middle school mathematics. So if you teach sixth grade math or seventh grade math, and you've got to now have this little certification behind your name to be highly qualified for mathematics, well, now you've got to go really study. I'll be honest, the first time I took it, I didn't pass. I missed it by one point. But when I took the exam, you know, they make you take your shoes off, hand over all your jewelry.
Because they think y'all will cheat?
I don't know.
Is that what that is?
It was really funny. I was really in a great mood going in, but coming out of the test, I was almost in tears because I ran out of time. I had like 10 questions left.
Wait, is there any, like if you go take an LSAT or if you go take the bar, you have a sister who's a certified attorney, and she's taking the bar. Did they make her take her shoes off?
I don't know. I haven't asked.
You've got me wondering now.
Well, this was at a university. You have to go take the test. You have to be checked in. I mean, they check your ID. There's also a second person there that checks all your stuff. You have to put your stuff in a locker. You're in a cubicle. You're in there testing with other people that might be testing for science or for special education. It was a very, I mean, you're videoed. There's a video camera on you while you're testing. So, yeah, I mean, I guess it's a problem.
It's a big deal.
It is crazy. That's what I said. I was like, what do you think I'm going to do? I made a lot of inappropriate jokes that they did not laugh at. But leaving the test, I was almost in tears. And I said, I ran out of time. I don't think I did well. They flash a score up, I guess, for the administrator sees like my immediate score, but you wait and have to get mailed your score because there's some that are open-ended questions or whatever. And she said, actually, I think you did really well in this whole semester of people coming in and taking this test. Nobody has passed. And I said, are you kidding me? And she said, yeah, I think you might pass. I think you did well. I said, I don't think I passed. I said, I saw that score and I know what I have to have and I think I missed it by like one question. And she said, yeah, but there's other questions, whatever. But yeah, I didn't pass. And I was so upset. And I'm a great math teacher. And so I got on a couple of blogs after taking this math exam because I was really embarrassed, I have to say. I have a master's degree. So it was kind of like, wait a minute, wait. Yeah. On the blogs nationwide, there's so many teachers that are really upset. And these are teachers that have been teaching for like 10 years.
Right. So you know they're good teachers.
Absolutely. And, yeah. But they just want this behind their name. Now, the story out of Florida is talking about new teachers. So we're actually turning away people who want to be in the classroom.
When there's clearly a shortage across the country.
Absolutely a shortage. So these teachers get turned away, yet what do we do to fill the spots? Oh, we just have long-term subs. I'm sorry. How is that good? That's not good.
No. Nick, what's your take on this?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I was, and I don't mean to brag or anything, but in 2000, I was fortunate enough to be considered the district's teacher of the year. And then it went on to the state level and I got all the way up to the state level. I didn't make it, but I got close. And during the interview process, this exact question came up, which was creating higher standards for teachers. Because the goal was then to increase teacher pay. And they never felt like, well, you know, in order for us to, in order for folks to warrant higher pay, then we expect higher standards. And so there was this vicious circle or cycle that would say, you know, if you're going to expect more money, then we should expect better results. But I think the testing of that is not really what it should be focused on. As you mentioned, there's a lot of good teachers out there who are already teaching that may not be able to pass the new certifications. And it really doesn't have anything to do with their ability to teach because there's simply just some things that you can't test that make you a great teacher. Your interaction with students, your ability to convey information to students in a way that keeps them exciting and energized. Sure, there's content standards that people need. They need to understand the content that they're teaching. But I don't know that we've found that mix yet.
What jumped out at me in the Florida story was the university professors. It wasn't just students complaining. The university professors were like, this is getting out of control. This is a little bit ridiculous. And the actual statistics show that there's a massive drop in teachers who want to teach and their ability to get certified because of the tougher test.
Right. And they're able to pass certain sections of the test, but one section get them, you know, that they can't pass. You know, there was a teacher that said, yeah, out of these 10 students right here that are going to take the test, one will pass. What upset me was at the end of the story, you know, they asked this young lady that just seems like she has such a light inside of her. And they said, you know, well, how does this make you feel? And she said, well, I'm embarrassed. And she shouldn't be embarrassed. And it did. It upset me because I remember how I felt that day. And I was like, wait a minute. You know, I still have people coming back saying, you're the best math teacher I've ever had. Yeah, and I told my students, hey, I didn't pass that test. I ran out of time. You know, I did, and they were like, Miss Lissa, and I was like, it was tough, guys, and it was a time test, and it taught me that you guys are going to be timed. You know, the ACT, the SAT, you're going to be timed. If they would just alter that, sure, make the test harder, great, but don't give them a time restraint.
So, Nick, I know you were telling me about a story out of Denver that really grabbed my attention, because it sounds like Denver schools are considering changing the way they teach pretty much for the sophomore year on. Is that right?
That's right. It's an article in the Denver Business Journal about Denver public schools, and they're taking about 80 juniors and seniors into this pilot program that they're calling Career Residency. And what it deals with essentially is looking at the Swiss model. And so the Swiss encourage career choice much earlier in the process than we do over here. And, you know, we sort of have this general background education where we give you a lot of broad topics to cover that don't really sort of gel into one specific category or track. And so what they're doing is they're trying to follow that Swiss model, where in Switzerland they give about 230 different options at the 10th grade level for students to choose. And that's sort of different from our view here in America, where we think that we're sort of pigeonholing a student into one category or another and limiting their options. And I think that what they found is that being able to give them access to the types of skills and job opportunities that they might want to look at, and giving them access to that experience helps them to determine what it is that they truly want to do. What they're going to be able to do is they're going to be able to spend time with people in that field as an apprenticeship. You know,
that's what's key to me. I think that's a great thing.
Absolutely. Being able to get out with those people in the field to see what's going on day to day, to understand exactly what it is that you're getting into before you spend, you know, $100,000 in college. And I'm interested to see the results.
I think it's huge, the mentorship and the, you know, apprenticeships and stuff with these rising high schoolers. I mean, as a mother of a now 17-year-old, it is really scary to think that he doesn't really have a clear grasp on maybe what he wants to do or major in college, because he hasn't been exposed to some of these things that he possibly would be interested in. And it would be hard for me as a parent to expose him to some of these things. Like, it's like, well, yeah, that's cool, but, you know, how do I get him even around this certain thing? If there were, I feel like this is going to help. I wish I had it in our area, because you're right. By the time you go to college and spend a lot of money, you've wasted 2 years then to decide you want to switch to something else.
You know, we have this industrial narrative right now with the way we do things in school, where we're given this broad-based education so that you can go out and decide what it is that you want to do. And, you know, you hear folks like Mike Rowe talking about blue collar jobs and vocational routes out there,
right,
jobs that need to be filled in our educational system, the way it's set up now.
No, you go get a liberal arts degree and you spend a ton of money and you can't do anything that actually needs to be done in many cases.
You know, Lisa, we had something similar to this in the vocational track, where they do spend some time in the field on, you know, it's a very limited amount of time, and it's been successful. So I'm curious to see if we don't spend more time looking at that and trying to emulate that across the board.
You know, one thing that I kind of told myself that I wouldn't do when I did this podcast is that was get into politics. But I do have a political story that I want to talk about, and I think we can do that and still remain apolitical in this topic. So out of Wall Township, New Jersey, a high school teacher there has apparently been suspended because she edited, I guess she was somehow in charge of the yearbook, and she edited a student's pro-Trump shirt out of the yearbook picture. So, and I'll put the picture on our website at classdismissedpodcast.com if you actually want to see the picture. But I mean, you can clearly see he's got this Trump Make America Great Again shirt. That was the original picture. And then you look at the yearbook picture and it's just a blue shirt and it's completely edited out. And the district's upset about it. So I kind of wanted y'all's take on that. I've got my own opinion, but Nick, we'll start with you. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that you know, I don't think that was the right thing to do. I think if the district had a policy that allowed that shirt to be worn, then it being a part of the their school picture, then it should have remained as it was and not pulled away. It's a difficult gray area because students' rights are limited a little bit when they enter the campus because of, you know, safety for all of the students, you know.
And I checked, they had not. There was no dress code restrictions for letting his son wear a Trump T-shirt for the school pictures. And actually, other students have worn political shirts in the past.
Right. Well, sure. Did she say why? Like, is it because she doesn't like Trump? Like, what was the reason? Like, why?
Yeah, no, she's not commenting. Oh. She's been suspended.
She gone.
A school board, well, she's suspended. school board member basically apologized, and even the father of the students, like, I don't think there's a deep-seated like political motivation, but it kind of, I look at it like this. Let's forget about that it was Trump. Let's just assume, if you, no matter what side of the political aisle you are, what if it said Obama and it was, you know, you could say that both shirts were edited out. Would you feel any different about it? Put the politics aside. And
I mean, even if it said Obama, even if it said, you know,
Clinton,
Reagan, or, like, yeah, you know, people still wear those throwback shirts. Like, mm-hmm. I love those throwback shirts personally, but like, my first question would still be, but why? Why did you do that? Like, why was that something that needed to be blurred out or whatever?
The thing that concerns me the most about this is the reaction to this right now. Or is the district going to go out and create all these policies that start limiting things as sort of a knee-jerk reaction to this?
I know.
And that's what we tend to do in education, is to, every time something causes an issue or a potential legal problem for us, then we go and create some draconian policy that limits things even more.
I know.
And so as teachers, yeah, we're just dancing around policy all the time instead of being able to do what we need to do.
I think a lot of people would agree with you on that, Nick. You know, the next step is, the next question is, the parents are now asking that the yearbook be reprinted with the original picture. Is that a step too far, in y'all's opinion? Because that would be expensive, right?
No, I don't feel like the parents are going too far. Number one, they paid for that yearbook photo, and it was altered probably without their knowledge. So, I mean, maybe the parents are trying to make a bit of a statement, like, hey, you've got to make this right. She did something that there was no really basis for it, so now we need to make this right. And so, I mean, it's a sign of the times. I mean, this was a huge election year. So if that's what that little boy wanted to get up and wear for his school photo, and his parents gave him the thumbs up as he walked out the door, like, I don't blame the parents for saying, hey, let's fix this. Even if they just reprint his yearbook, sure. But if they want to reprint the whole school's yearbook, I mean, I guess they have the right to make everyone notice.
Mm. What do you think, Nick?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that from a cost standpoint, it could be, you know, cost prohibitive to have to go back and redo all that. But I do understand that this student was... He was a high school student who had reached the age to vote, and he voted in his first election, and he was real proud about that. And so that's why he wanted to wear a shirt, as sort of a commemoration of, you know, hey, this was the year that I was able to vote.
I was over the yearbook.
Oh, were you?
For 4 years.
And they're expensive, right?
They are expensive, but you pay for them. The parents pay for them. So
who would pick up the tab if they had to do a reprint for this one picture? Should the teacher pick up the tab?
Well, I'm sure what the school will say, and probably can say, is we can't cover the cost to get the entire, you know, school's reprint, because everybody individually pays for their own, but we can reprint yours and pay for you to have, you know, some reprinted. I had yearbooks sent to me once that were misprinted, like they printed first grade twice, you know, and it, no one was left out, you know, but first grade was printed twice, and they sent us, the yearbook company sent us all of that, but that was their mistake. This is this yearbook editor's mistake. And you know,
I think that's a good solution, though. If they could get, you know, this one student's, of course, then again, he's thinking about all of his friends and years later when they look back at the yearbook picture and those kind of things, and him not being that represented that way in everyone else's yearbook, because it is sort of, you know, his speech in a way.
Maybe his one-year book would be really valuable because it's the one-year book that has the Trump shirt.
Yeah, it'd be like a limited edition.
Yes, I bet Trump would be like, I will purchase that yearbook for
that might be a bridge too far, I don't know. Well, you know, if you are listening and you have a strong opinion about this, remember you can email us your opinion at info@classdismisspodcast.com. Again, that's info@classdismisspodcast.com. We'll take it in writing. We'll take even an audio clip. And if we get one, we may play it on a future show. So we'll leave that topic at that for now. Hey, guys, you know what we have coming up is we have a bright idea. Our new bright idea segment is going to actually be with a scientist for the first time.
I'm actually excited because I know a little bit about this topic, and it's really, really cool.
All right, well, let's jump right into it. We'll head on over into our bright idea segment. In today's Bright Idea, we have our first scientist joining us. Dr. Steve Farber is an investigator in the embryology department of the Carnegie Institution for Science and is an adjunct associate professor in the Johns Hopkins biology department. Dr. Farber, how are you doing?
Great.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Farber, I've looked at your bio. It's extremely impressive. You have tons of schooling up and down the East Coast, but you've also dedicated a significant amount of time and resources to K-12 science education, and you do this with a program you call BioEyes, and BioEyes really all started with a fish, right?
Correct.
Tell me about that.
Well, I would start by saying I take myself back to 2002, and I was a new assistant professor at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. And they had started a tradition of doing a take your child to work day. And you can't have a lot of little kids running around a big city hospital research environment. So they organized that effort in that all the kids were brought together in one big room and they were taken on tours. And someone had the bright idea, you know, let's bring them to Farber's lab. It's like the aquarium because my animal of choice that I work on for my science is zebrafish. And they had just built me a state-of-the-art zebrafish facility. And so they brought the kids to see the fish. And so I set up little stations where they could see these fish larvae at different stages. And since zebrafish are optically clear, you can see right through their bodies at every cell. That's why we use them to study, in my lab, cardiovascular disease and diabetes and all kinds of things that to help people. So the kids came in through the lab and they saw the beating heart. And at the end of the whole day, guess whose program was considered the most interesting? It was Farber's lab.
Hey. Right?
So what I learned about any big institution is that if you do something well, there's one thing that's going to happen to you. You're going to get asked to do that thing over and over and over again. And so all of a sudden, I had all these tours, and my lab started to complain. They're like, Steve, you know, we're getting all these tours. So my wife suggested to me, who's a social psychologist, a PhD, she's like, if the university is so interested in having you show off these fish, why don't they give you a little funds to hire someone? So I was walking in my building in my usual attire of jeans, which could have had a rip in them, and a t-shirt. And I noticed this big display of coconut shrimp and wine, and thinking, you know, I'm a professor now. Even though it was for the surgeons, they were having some event. I said, you know, I'm going to take a bunch of these shrimp and wine because, you know, I don't know, I like that stuff. So I grabbed some of it, turn around, and then who's in front of me but the dean of medicine. And I just look at him and say, like, you're the dean, right? And he goes, Farber, you just got this Pew Scholar Award, and I sponsored a group that came to your lab, and they had a great time. And then that comment from my wife came out. And I go, you know what? If I can get some money to hire someone,
right,
this would be a lot more effective. And he looked at me like quizzically, and then he said, "Look, I can get you like $35,000, but if you, but you'll need to go to the other deans. Don't tell them it was me. Tell them an unnamed dean, and find the rest of the money for the salary." And he started it. And the key moment there was the person I hired was a former teacher who had a master's degree at the time in science education, Jamie Shuda. And I interviewed her with my 8-year-old son. Mm-hmm. I interviewed one other candidate. And her charisma and interaction with my son was so notable that and enthusiasm, she got the job. And she took this crazy idea. You see, when I went to a classroom, I lined kids up behind a microscope. They're like punching each other. I don't know how to run a classroom at all, you know? And so Jamie, the first thing she did was ground the whole program in existing standards. Fast forward, we have 100,000 kids that have done this. And what the success of this program is because we hooked together a scientist who really wanted to improve STEM education with a tried and true teacher who understood how classrooms work.
Well, I have to say, as a teacher, even though I'm not a science teacher, I feel like across the nation, there's so many new young educators that we don't even really dabble too much in the sciences.
I learned that this program is a teacher professional development program. I used to think it was the kids. It was all about the kids. But now I understand that when you change a teacher, when you enable a teacher to feel comfortable with a scientific concept and tools, you affect that teacher for their entire career. You know, this is what I tell the teachers when they come in for their weekend, their PD. I say, look, my lab is concerned with stuff that's not on the internet. It's not in Wikipedia. It's at the frontiers of knowledge. It's stuff that we have to create. And I want the brightest, smartest, most diverse, talented people to come to my lab. And before they're in my lab, they're in your classrooms. And I am just so psyched that you are coming to this training because we're all on the same team. And you should see the reaction of the teacher, the idea that I would think of them as a partner. And that is not like bull. I mean, it is my feel. It's my heart. That's why I do this.
You know, you're almost awakening inside them what was never really sparked from the beginning.
Exactly. Exactly. There are so many issues that BioWise offers that we didn't know when we did it. For example, it's a fifth grade and seventh grade modules. And in fifth grade, you know, it's what is the words? Male, female, sperm, egg, embryo. The kids actually figure out which is a male and which is a female, and they put them together, and then they collect the embryos the next morning. Well, I think it's obvious, right? This is about sex. And we're talking about the United States, which in school settings all over the country, that issue is challenging for teachers, even though it's clearly age appropriate. So that aligns with national standards. But because it's fish, and because they just swim near each other and you don't have any mechanical issues to discuss, literally no one gets upset about that curriculum topic. So as a scientist, that's kind of a fun aspect. Second aspect is, what is the experiment? Well, the kids have to mate a fish that does not have pigment to a fish that does have pigment. Now, in the high school unit, they learn about the genetics of pigmentation. Well, that's race. And so most kids in an urban setting, their only concept of race is a social construction. And what they learn with our unit is there's one gene that was actually discovered in fish that explains the biggest chunk of why somebody's skin is darker or lighter. And there's one little change that happened in that gene to make skin lighter. And they come away with an entirely different perspective than they had before. So these are two really difficult topics that are relevant but are challenging for teachers to address. But when you do it with a fish in the way we do, you can have all these discussions. Even in fifth grade, you can see the kids are so focused on the fish. They're looking at the fish and they'll say, like, my female doesn't like my male because she is running away. And they project so much of our sex role stereotypes on the fish, you know, and they go in there thinking right off the bat, because the female fish is so much bigger than the male, they always think that the male is the female is the male. Mm-hmm. So that's against their expectation. Then when they learn, when they dig into that a little more, they'll realize, oh, the female's bigger because she has so many eggs, right? And then we put this little tree in there so the male can actually hide, because sometimes the female's so much bigger, she'll whack him, the male's dead. So this little male is in there, and then it's the female is assessing the male. So from a scientific concept, we can introduce fitness. Like, if you're, and they'll say, like, my they're chasing. So you could sit down with fifth graders and go to the board and say, okay, what kind of skills do you need to chase? You need to have good muscles, you have to see, you have to do this. And you make this whole list and you realize, like, well, what if my male's like sick? Do you want to waste your eggs on a sick male? So then all of a sudden, they're thinking about how the female is deciding from the male's performance. Like, is this male any good? Well, it's so interesting when you see how they have all these biases about the way people act. So it's just extra fun when it happens in fish to be opposite the other way. Then kids come in with the sex biases that the male is the one making these decisions, and actually the female is the one assessing everything. You can go to BioEyes.org and see some of the movies. You'll see every kid from across the world, and they act the same. They just stare at these fish. For, they could even be special needs. There's something about a living creature, and they make very similar observations. So I think that's another aspect about why BioEyes is so effective, because the kids focus amazingly intently.
So can you give me an example of a time maybe you were working with a child and you just saw them get it?
Some teachers would develop PowerPoints and kind of tell kids the outcome, and I'd have to go, no, you got to let them make these, quote, mistakes. And there's an amazing movie from Baltimore County of a team of kids where they're being interviewed, and they said, you know, our group had 234 embryos, and we were really excited. But then we accidentally put them on top of the heating pad instead of in the special container. Oops. And then it cuts to the other girl, and she said, well, look, in science, mistakes happen. Mm-hmm. And we put them in this container they shouldn't have been, and then she looks into the camera and goes, so they all died. And, you know, when you show this to scientists, the room erupts in laughter, because it's like, welcome to our world.
Right.
And why I love that is you can tell a great teacher was behind that, because that teacher coached that child and said, look, this is part of the scientific process. So allowing kids to have that experience and to kind of not succeed is as much an important part as succeeding. Sometimes the kids set up the cross in the male and the female, and guess what? She doesn't like the male or whatever, and that animal, that pair doesn't lay eggs. Well, we introduced the concept of adoption. So one of the other teams has to give embryos to their other classmates. Well, you can imagine a group, like if a group has 500 eggs, they're giving them out to the other team. That group thinks they are in the top of the world, you know? They're walking around the class like, our group got 580 eggs and we have to give them to everybody else. So I think the ownership is obvious. And then even the very fact that they have to pick up the dish and carry it across the room, and so they're so careful, and the almost you could see their pressure in a classroom, they're like holding the dish. Well, I think all that emotion helps the learning process, because they're like holding the fate of these animals literally in their hands.
True.
And we bring writing skills in, because we say you have to write an essay from this perspective of the embryo, from the larvae. And they all write about, I was really worried my parents were going to eat me, or the students came over to suck the poop out of my dish, and I was worried if I was going to get sucked up, but I didn't get sucked up. So, you know, kids have a universal reaction to some of these kinds of things, whether they're in Australia or Chile or the United States. And I think when you talk to a fifth grader about the idea how these animals do sometimes eat their babies, that's like pretty. There's one kid on one of the movies says, I was talking to my dad at dinner, and I was telling him that these parents, these they can eat their babies. He says, that's not being a good parent, that's, you know? And so this is the natural world. This is, you know, sometimes we're so worried about making everything perfect for kids, and they should know that different animals have different strategies.
I pardon the pun. I'm hooked. I am so excited about this. And I have two boys that meet the age range that you keep referring to for these modules. I would love to know how to tell a teacher or a principal or educator, what do they do?
Well, I mean, this is our biggest challenge, what you're touching on, because people all want to have the program. The first thing, the good news is that the zebrafish is such an amazing model system for the lab setting. Like, a mouse costs about $1 a mouse a day. A fish costs about $2 or $3 a year.
Wow.
And we now know, I mean, this may be shocking to your listeners, but it's the same sets of genes that are in us are in the fish. So
wow.
If we're trying to figure out how a gene works, or if we're trying to find a new drug, it turns out it works often exactly the same. So you can find, so there's all these great reasons that make the fish an amazing system are the same reasons it makes it great in a class. But because the fish is now in all the major universities, you, or most, the first thing is, are you based near an academic university that has a fish system going? And then you build from there. Like some of the faculty who've never done it before, we have to kind of launch BioEye. So it isn't the kind of thing you can kind of order a textbook and do it. We've had motivated teachers really figure out how to do this with pet store fish and stuff. But that takes a lot of effort.
Right.
So we have all the, what we call our replication model is in our last publication, which is in PLOS, in PL, the Public Library of Science Biology, which is a high profile form journal. We published what it takes to replicate, but so you need the academic institution, you need the kind of infrastructure sort of built to support the delivery. So they reach out to bioeyes.org. We have, right after our paper came out, we have like 90 requests for replication across the globe, with a large chunks in the U.S. So all of the UC schools out in California, UCLA, UC Davis, Boston, the Harvard and MIT, you have all on the East Coast schools. So the major big name schools, we've seen a lot of activities happen there, but it does require a connection to an academic center.
Dr. Farber, kudos to you and your team for taking, you know, science and what's complicated and getting kids interested in it. Are you ready for our pop quiz?
All right, I'm ready.
All right.
I had my coffee. I'm all geared up.
All right, it shouldn't be too tough.
Okay.
If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be? I think I know what your answer is going to be.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go with, well, you thought I was going to say science, and I probably would, but history is really important too, so that's
all
a
right.
tie.
You threw me for a loop there. What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
Analytic thinking and open-ended questions that kind of STEM touches on, because, you know, memorizing stuff is not the way, you know, isn't going to address the challenges we have in the future. And tackling big, complicated, messy problems requires students to really think critically. And those are hard. Look, I know as a professor, you ask those kinds of questions, they're hard to grade. So we have to give teachers more time and stuff to ask and teach in that way.
What does every child deserve?
Well, they deserve an awesome education. And I am passionate about that. And I think in the sad, sad thing, and I know you want quick answers, but the sad, sad thing is if you're wealthy in this country, yeah, you get a much, much richer education than if you're not. And that isn't what this country is about. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think that situation has been getting worse in the last few years.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
Well, I think there's been an incredible increase in overall knowledge. And so it's not about learning facts, because every kid's got all the facts of the universe on their smartphone now. It's about thinking skills.
Yeah, that's a good point. What teacher changed your life?
That one's easy. My fourth grade teacher, I was an extremely shy kid who never spoke up. And my fourth grade teacher knew I was a science nerd at some level. And she actually sent me home with these little science projects that were like kits.
Mm-hmm.
And then she asked me to teach the class electricity. So in fourth grade, we built batteries that I actually taught my fourth grade class. And that teacher got me out of my shell. I wonder if I would be a scientist without her.
Wow, and look where we are today.
And yeah, who would have imagined I would have gone to MIT and started this whole program, and she's the one. I mean, and what fourth grade teacher has their student teach the lectures on did the electricity unit? My kids, some of my, at a reunion, a couple people came up to me once and said, I remember when you taught fourth grade to our fourth grade electricity. So
that's really cool. Last question, pen or pencil?
Pencil.
Is that a scientist thing? I'm assuming that is.
Well, actually, pen. You're supposed to write your lab books in pen, but
Oh, really?
Because you don't want to change them.
Oh, that's a good point.
But I just feel more at ease with a pencil.
Gotcha. Well, again, Dr. Farber, we really appreciate all your time, and we love the great things you're doing for K through 12 education. I'll take an extra step and put links to y'all's website in our show notes if anyone wants to catch up.
Thank you for having me on.
All right.
I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
And that's going to do it for episode 4 of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or a comment, remember you can email us at info@classdismissed.com. We're here to support educators, but we also need your support. So if you like the show, please give us a 5-star review on iTunes. We may even read your review on a future show. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismissed. On behalf of Nick Peterman with School Status and Lissa representing all of the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortigo, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed.